Hey guys, welcome back to Filibusted. We have been away for just a little bit. We're happy to be back. I think the bigger question, though, is Pat, did you miss me?
Always.
There it
is. Every second of every long day.
There it is. For those of you that are regular followers of Filibusted, the last thing you probably saw from us was our live coverage of the election that had a lot of surprises in it, obviously. And we're going to break down some things that have happened since then. And kind of lay out some things that are that we have to look forward to, maybe not look forward to. We'll kind of see as we go through. My name is Griffin Browning. My co-host, as always, is Pat Deering. We have Brian Doney filming, recording, editing for us. Our saving grace, the future of America, that kind of thing. I think the first thing that we have to talk about is let's start with the inauguration. Where were you on the day Trump was inaugurated?
So I was at work most of the day. I didn't watch any of his speech, anything like that. You know, followed the typical media outlet, Twitter, static. But outside of that, I didn't really pay much attention. But then that afternoon, I found myself heading to Washington, D.C. to participate in the Women's March the following day. And got there kind of late-ish evening. Friday night.
And in the interest of full disclosure, Inauguration Day, I did actually make an effort. I kind of went back and forth on whether or not I was going to watch it. I felt like it made sense to ultimately make an effort to watch it just because I knew we were going to talk about it and it seems like something worth watching. In full disclosure, though, I did make an effort to watch it. I actually fell asleep during the inauguration. It was so uneventful.
It was, and yeah.
I'm not sure what people expected, but I think more so than the inauguration itself is what we've seen right after the inauguration, which is where the Women's March that you just mentioned. Do you want to talk a little bit about your experience of going to D.C. and actually being a part of that right after the inauguration?
It was absolutely incredible, and there's not really, you know, much more I can say about it that the women that participated in the march haven't already said themselves, which I think is kind of the point of the march. And, you know, I was there supporting, but also I was primarily there to listen to women's stories, listen to their fears about this upcoming administration, and, you know, kind of stand behind them in solidarity, not necessarily be there for myself. And it was, I've never seen anything like it. D.C. was totally, totally unprepared for the hundreds of thousands of people that showed up. I think they were thinking maybe 200,000 would show up, and more than twice that were there. The mall was packed, Constitution was packed, Independence was packed, Pennsylvania Avenue was packed, the Ellipse in front of the White House was packed, and the protest was spilling out into streets they didn't even have a permit for. Traffic was blocked, the metro was totally overloaded, buses weren't running. It was absolutely incredible.
Why do you think we saw such a magnitude of protest as opposed to any? I guess people talk about the role of protest a lot and a lot more recently, but I think that what we saw this last weekend kind of stood out as, first of all, a very successful protest. We've heard very little incidents of violence surrounding the protest. I did see something earlier. I don't know if this is true or not, which we will talk about truth in the media here in a little bit, but that there weren't no arrests in D.C. as a result of the protest. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, that sounds completely accurate. I actually, there were a handful of National Guardsmen milling about at some of the cross streets, and I did see a couple of ambulances and maybe three or four police cruisers. There was a totally minimal police presence there.
Why do you think that was compared to some other protests we've seen?
Well, one, it was in D.C., and the D.C. police are very used to dealing with protests. They tend not to overreact and go totally nuclear like all of our Midwest police forces do. The second more than five people gather on a corner, they need to roll out the Humvee and start cracking skulls. D.C. police are used to protests, so they're you know, they handle themselves very well in these situations. Two, the city was planned, I think, for far fewer people, so they didn't have all that many mobilized. And then also, you know, the march had a lot of official support, you know, a huge number of national figures were there speaking. You know, the director of Planned Parenthood was there. Madonna came and swore at people. Janelle Monáe performed. It was in just a whole slew of activists across many different communities within feminism. And I think because it had that national official support, you know, there are elected officials speaking as well, it wasn't, you know, really seen as threatening. And then also, you know, the crowd was, you know, it was a wonderfully diverse crowd, but it was primarily white. So.
Actually, because you were there, it does seem like that's the way it's kind of been reported, that it was primarily white women. Is that an accurate assessment of, the protest?
Yes. I mean, it was fantastically diverse, but it was mostly white women. And, you know, every community was represented, but of course it was overwhelmingly white.
Yeah.
Part of that's, you know, the travel expenses of getting to D.C. Part of that's being in D.C., which is the most expensive city in the country from my perspective. And also, you know, feminism is something that is in many ways still kind of, you know, led and sort of controlled by white women. You might hear the term white feminism thrown around. But I think that this march was also kind of a coming to grips for mainstream feminists with that. You know, they did a completely laudable job making this march as intersectional and as representative and as safe as they possibly could. They get it 100% right? No. But, you know, they really put the effort out there and it really paid off.
Now, let's think about the march in terms of a little bigger picture here, and two questions, and they may actually have the same answer. What do you think will be the ultimate result of the march, and what do you hope would be the result of the march?
You know, this march will absolutely be something that goes down in the history books. You know, it was not only a huge gathering in Washington, D.C., it was huge in New York and L.A., and London, you know, cities all across the United States, cities across the world, you know, even Cleveland turned out 15,000 people in their streets that day. And early estimates are showing that about 3 million women around the world protested as part of this event. That could very well be the largest mass protest in history. In the United States, it's absolutely the largest protest in American history at this point in time. You know, maybe not the largest in any single city, but all those cities together, definitely the largest. And that's going to be remembered. Also, I think that this is going to pour quite a bit of support into organizations that make women's rights central to their operations, whether it be Planned Parenthood, NARAL, the ACLU. You know, organizations like that are going to see quite a bit of support coming their way, I think, financially and, you know, publicly. And also, I think that feminism is going to become a bigger topic in mainstream, I guess, political discourse and also in, like, media coverage. You know, this protest caught a lot of people's attention. You know, I would hope that it leads to some type of recognition, you know, either from the president or from the Republican-controlled Congress, that what they are doing right now is not something beneficial to women. Attacking abortion access, attacking health care, these are things that, you know, hurt women in the United States. I don't know if that will be the result, though.
Why do you think this march, and we have seen a lot of protests recently, why do you think that this march stands out as one that was so effectively organized and also was able to follow through on that promise and actually getting people to show up and stand up for it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I really call it effectively organized. You know, the organization as far as the speakers go and, you know, making sure that everybody was represented through the speakers, you know, the official program was deeply intersectional. The city wasn't prepared. The organizers weren't prepared for the number of people that showed up. They didn't have the permits. They didn't have, you know, the screens and the speaker systems for this stuff. You know, most people who were there probably didn't hear a word of the program because they were so far away from where the stage was set up. And I think that's a testament to the fact that Donald Trump does truly frighten women in this nation. And there's no way to whitewash it. You know, he has never acted in the benefit of women in general a single time in his business career, and he certainly doesn't seem poised to do it in his political career. You know, there might be examples of him, you know, benefiting individual women, especially individual women who are close to him or who are already wealthy themselves. But women in general and women as a community, absolutely not. And because of that, I think women as a community really are terrified of what his presidency could mean to them, what it could mean to their children, what it could mean to their families, and also are really just terrified that the 50 states, you know, were willing to go along with this man.
Yeah. Do you think that there's some way that women as an oppressed group will be able to kind of join together with other oppressed groups? Because it did seem like there were people calling out certain things about this protest. A large part of it was that it seems like it was made up mostly of white women. People were kind of calling it out as sort of a distraction from other issues. Do you see that as a real concern, that maybe they could join together? Or what do you think that the result there will be?
I mean, I think that's penultimately the goal. You might hear something thrown around on social media or in conversation, you know, with people who follow these sorts of things. You might hear people say something like, my feminism will be intersectional or it will be bullshit. And I think that is the penultimate goal, that you do make feminism as accessible as possible for all people, you know, regardless of their race, their religion, you know, regardless of the makeup of their genitalia. You know, not all women have vaginas, and not all people with vaginas are women. And that is something that is absolutely on the radar of activists, and I think it's something they're working on. But, you know, that's an immensely difficult thing to do. And, you know, because something like this march, you know, spans multiple generations, multiple regions, multiple world outlooks, that can be tough. And, you know, there were some examples of that in the march, but I think it is possible, and there are some very intelligent, incredibly talented women working on that. And then also, you know, it is kind of like ironic that we're sitting here talking about intersectionality and we got two dudes talking about the women's march. You know, this would make a lot more sense if it was a woman saying these things.
No one is more intersectional than me, Pat. Lastly, before we move on to a couple other things, I do want to ask you, moving forward, obviously there were a lot of, not just women, there were a lot of people in general that wanted to support the march or wanted to be at the march. Obviously not everyone is able to do that. Moving forward, what are some ways, either locally or nationally, that people can still support that cause and stand up for women's rights?
You know, they really are the basics that we harp on all the time. They kind of form the core of that. Donate to organizations that advocate for these things. Planned Parenthood, NARAL, the National Abortion Funds, donate to those. Donate to organizations that fight for civil liberties, the ACLU, the NAACP. You know, write to your senators and your representatives. Call your senators and representatives. You know, stop in at their offices. They have constituent offices back in their home districts. Stop in, you know, and give them the what for in person. You might be talking to an aide, but you can still, you know, make yourself known and make yourself heard there. And just always make sure that whatever it is you're doing, you are always advocating for the people in the group that are the most oppressed. You know, whoever it is that has the smallest soapbox to stand on, who has the smallest voice because of their position, whether it be, you know, their gender orientation, their financial situation, their race, whatever it might be, always make sure that you are hearing and amplifying the voice of the most oppressed.
All right. The next thing that I want to make sure we talk about, which is actually kind of been brought to light as a response to the Women's March and also the inauguration, which seems like it's going to become a bigger issue throughout Trump's presidency, is his relationship with the media and the press. Heavy sigh from Pat. It seems like within his first couple days as president, Trump has already started to wage sort of a war against the press, even saying such things like the media will pay a big price for their coverage of the inauguration. What do you imagine that price will be?
Nothing.
Nothing.
No, I mean, like, if he tries anything from a legal perspective, like, the spotlight's already on that. You know, organizations that fight those sorts of things will be there with their attorneys to fight him, you know, immediately. You know, he's never going to make big gains in dismantling the free press in the United States. Is what he can do, though, and is what he will do, and is what he is doing when he says those things, is he will continue to drive his followers, the hardcore Trump people, away from mainstream media into media outlets that he controls, whether it be Breitbart or, you know, whatever it might be. You know, he forces people towards those by tearing down mainstream media, public media, funding for the arts, anything that could be critical of him. Even though he can't legally do anything about them, he can continually convince his followers not to pay attention, to only read what he tells them to read, and thereby prevent them from learning anything new and from ever deviating in their support of him.
What do you think the best defense against that strategy would be if, you know, someone who does not subscribe to Trump's beliefs or his idea of factual media, how do the rest of us combat trying to inform that group of people that are refusing to listen to media?
Ooh, I guess that's the that's the million-dollar question. You know, I'm not too sure there's anything you can do about it, you know, large scale. But I will say that don't tolerate it from your family and from your closest acquaintances. If they're reading that kind of stuff, always, always, always debate it. Always, always, always point out the facts. Always, always, always throw the real sources at them. Don't ever, ever, ever let anybody get away with quoting Breitbart as fact. I don't care if it ruins Easter dinner or it ruins the 4th of July for your family, or if your sister who ran out to Colorado and married some guy that lives in a compound decides that she's never going to talk to you again. Never, ever, ever tolerate it.
Well, if you're anything like me, family dinners are usually ruined much sooner than that would even be brought up. So you don't have a whole lot to lose. I do want to ask you, this is something that I think people have theorized on a little bit. I don't know if people have started to fully talk about it yet. Do you think that there are people that voted for Donald Trump that since his inauguration or even in the last couple of days, or even before that, as he started to nominate cabinet members, do you think that he has lost some of the support that voted for him?
Absolutely. I mean, there haven't been any large-scale polls or, you know, any sort of statistical analysis of it. And most of the stories that I've heard and most of the, you know, what I've experienced is, of course, all anecdotal. And as we all know, anecdote is worthless. But I would say that that absolutely does exist. And you can't put a number to it. You can't quote it in a study or anything, but it exists. You know, personally, I do already know one person who's expressed that to me. It was someone who had lost their job at a Central Ohio based shipping distribution facility to an automated robotic forklift. And then because of that, soon defaulted on their mortgage and subsequently was foreclosed on. So he owned a home, loses job, loses home, now rents and works minimum wage. So the whole Make America Great Again stuff really appealed to him. He really bought into it. You know, he really wanted to feel like he could blame China for the loss of his job. And he really wanted to believe that Donald Trump was going to have rural, you know, Ohioans at the heart of his administration. The thing is, though, the bank that foreclosed on this man's house was One West Lending. Donald Trump has just tapped to be his Secretary of Treasury that same man, the former CEO of One West, the CEO of the bank that foreclosed on this guy. So he's already expressed to me that he's immensely disappointed that he voted for Donald Trump and that he wishes he had just stayed home on Election Day.
And I think that it's really important for us to not forget that narrative, because there has to be huge parts of this country that probably felt like they had very real reasons to vote for Trump. And like you said, Make America Great Again is a story that will appeal to a lot of people that are struggling in this country. And it doesn't seem like he, at least what he's laid out so far, he doesn't seem to be too concerned with some of those people that voted for him. So I think that that is important to not forget about those people. There is a lot of talk going around of, you know, if you voted for Trump, I won't forgive you. And I think that that's, I guess maybe that's worth talking about a little bit. Do you think that at this point, people that voted for Trump, does that mean that they're unforgivable or they're deplorable or they're, you know, I think it's tough to know reasons why someone would actually vote for someone, especially after the fact when it seems like they're not going to follow through with some of the promises that maybe got them into the office in the first place. How should those people be treated?
You know, I always believe that if, you know, in second chances, if someone sees the light and realizes that what they did was wrong and they're not going to do it again, you know, I can forgive someone like that.
It's like a petulant child. Like,
right.
Don't do it again.
Yeah. Like, that was very silly.
Yeah.
Now look what you've done.
Yeah.
Those people I think can be forgiven. Honestly, they need to be. Like, the Democratic Party isn't going to rebuild itself if it doesn't reach out to those people. And the most vulnerable people can reach out to now are the people who thought they were going to get a Donald Trump that fights for the lower middle class and lower class, and instead got a Donald Trump that appoints a former officer of Goldman Sachs to his cabinet.
Yeah.
We will need to reach out to those people. Though, I mean, there is a group of Trump voters, though, that, you know, they're never going to leave him. And they were driven to him by his promises of Muslim registries and building walls to keep out the Mexicans and starting trade wars with China over God knows what. These people who were driven entirely by effectively a racist campaign, like, no, we don't owe those people anything.
Yeah. As we kind of get to the end of this, obviously there's, it's getting harder and harder, to, I guess, figure out, you know, the truth. I can't believe I'm saying that. It's getting harder to make sure that the information that we're getting is the best information. Especially as a lot of people are relying on social media and Facebook for their news. So to kind of close out this episode of Filibytes, what are some things that, first of all, some stories that we should keep an eye on that people should be looking for? And also, how can we make sure that we're getting the best possible information at all times?
I'll start with the second one. The best way to make sure that you're getting the best possible information is to read. You know, you don't need to watch television. You don't need to be on Twitter. You don't need to be on Facebook. You don't need someone else just parroting off headlines in 30-second clips. Read. Subscribe to a newspaper. You know, one of the major national ones, you know, subscribe to your local newspaper if you live in a relatively large city. You know, don't go subscribing to something that's published in the basement of the local church. Like, that's bad news. Actually, literally bad news and also figurative bad news.
I forgot how witty you are.
That one snuck up on me. I didn't plan that one. You know, read the New York Times, read the Wall Street Journal, read the Washington Post, read what NPR puts out there, read the BBC, read the Guardian, read Al Jazeera. Make sure that your sources are broad and varied and that you read the same story in multiple outlets. And get into academic writing. You don't just need to read the news to get a feel for what's going on currently. You know, go to the library. Your local library has stacks of academic journals. You know, check out Foreign Affairs. You know, read something written by a major player in that field of policy. Don't just rely on quick summaries of things. And if you're doing all of that, you're going to get good information and you're going to make well-guided choices.
Now, if you don't like to read, Not all of us enjoy reading it. Oh, there it is. Yeah. What are some? Are there news networks that we should be looking at for coverage?
You know, I would say PBS, NPR, the BBC.
Oh, good. All the exciting ones.
Al Jazeera. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, those are all things you can watch. And, you know, if you've already read something or if you already feel like you have a grip on what's going on, there's no harm in checking out the mass televised
and then hearing some of the commentary that comes with it.
Yeah, I mean, because that is, you know, the thing about real journalism. Like, they're probably not going to have too much about whatever Kellyanne Conway just said, because whatever Kellyanne Conway just said is typically verified garbage. And, like, why would you repeat garbage? But, you know, if you want to keep abreast of the nonsense that's being tossed around, yeah, you can watch the news. Just make sure you have a grip of the issue before you do that.
So read as much as possible, watch as little as possible, and yeah. As far as some stories that you think that we should be keeping an eye on, just give us a few of those.
There has been a bill introduced to remove the United States from the UN. They're calling it the Restoring American Sovereignty Act. Pay close attention to that, because that would be an absolute disaster. Also, it's going to be a good litmus test for how willing the Republican Party will be to stand up to the Trump-leaning people in Congress. I don't believe that the crazy goes deep enough for there actually to be enough votes in the Senate to withdraw us from the UN. But I have been wrong in the past when evaluating the crazy level of your typical American politician. I would absolutely pay attention to that one. I would continue to follow the Affordable Care Act stories as closely as you can, especially because there's never going to be a straight-up vote to just repeal the Affordable Care Act. Trump's going to take pot shots at it with executive orders. He's already signed one his very first day in office, and he'll do everything that he can to make the Affordable Care Act as impotent and useless as possible without ever actually doing a full-scale repeal and inheriting the responsibility of creating a replacement. He'll leave it on the books, make it as ineffective as possible, and then continue to harp on how horrible the Affordable Care Act is. And if you're not constantly following that story and paying attention to every little thing that happens to it, whether it be the budget reconciliation, whether it be his executive orders, whatever is going on there, you're going to miss that narrative within that. And then also I would pay attention to just Europe in general. You know, just keep an eye on what British journalists and German journalists and French journalists and Spanish journalists are saying about all this. You know, listen for things about NATO, listen for things about the EU, because considering all the issues with Trump's possible ties to Vladimir Putin, that would be highly indicative that those are correct if we start failing on our obligations to our European allies. It would also be just disastrous for the balance of world power.
All right. I think that's a good starting place. I think it is also important. I think it's a good point you bring up that so far a lot of the policy changes that we've seen so far are pretty directly a result of Trump. We haven't really yet seen what the role of Republican lawmakers is going to be in either agreeing or disagreeing with Trump. So I think there is reasons, you know, if you don't agree with Trump's politics, there's still reasons to be hopeful that there are a lot of people that can still stand up to him or at least guide him in a better direction. You may not still agree with some of the choices that are made, but we can move away from probably the worst case scenario in some of these things. And obviously we have a lot to talk about in future episodes. And if you have anything you want to hear us talk about, get in touch with us, send us a message. We love in Filibytes to talk about some different issues that are coming up. And any final thoughts?
I have nothing here. I'm still processing the fact that Donald can't even handle that his inauguration speech crowd, that the crowd at his inaugural address wasn't the largest in history, and that he had to send his press secretary out there to repeat the lie, and then send Kellyanne Conway to NBC to continue to
reaffirm
and defend the lie.
Well, to be fair, alternative truth is the preferred.
I think it's alternative term. Facts.
I'm getting ahead of myself. Alternative truth will be the next thing, I think.
don't misnoun Kellyanne Conway's rhetoric.
Anyways, I think that's going to do it for us. Like I said, if you have anything you want us to talk about, get in touch with us. We love hearing your ideas, and we will have some new full episodes coming your way soon. My name is Griffin Browning. My co-host is Pat Deering. Big thank you to Brian Downey for everything he does. We'll see you guys next time.
Toddlers should not have guns.